The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly, and I'm Anne Perkins. The House of Commons in the latter part of the 18th century was an exciting place to be. It was hot, noisy, and close. Members carried swords and wore spurs. The modern notion of the party system was very much in its infancy. MPs were unpaid, and obviously men. But it was also a place of idealism and skullduggery. And one of its stars was the Irish-born Whig, Edmund Burke, the subject of an enthralling new biography by Conservative MP Jessie Norman. And Jessie joins me now. Jessie Norman, your last book was about compassionate conservatism, the big society. I wonder why you've gone back 200 or so years to investigate a philosopher who's not often talked about these days.
It's a very interesting question. I think Burke, in many respects, is the foundational thinker of that set of ideas, because it's really Burke who sets out an idea of politics which has society not as a kind of add-on, but built into it from the very, very beginning. And Burke thinks that the task of political leaders is to preserve society as an inheritance which they have received in the interests not merely of those alive today, but of those yet to be born, and indeed also of those who have already died. And when you have this idea of society as a trust, then that imposes an obligation to preserve it, to enhance it, to pass it on safe and well. And it also imposes a kind of duty of modesty on politicians and of moderation on policy. And that seems to me to fit very well with the social aspects of the big society.
Are you really saying that you see Burke and compassionate conservatism as an antidote for the recent past of the Conservative Party?
Well, not so much the recent past of the Conservative Party. Of course, the politics of it is a slightly different matter. We're really just talking about the ideas at the moment, and the politics sometimes reflects those ideas and sometimes is at variance with them. No, but Burke is really an antidote to two poles of political debate over the last 100 years, I suppose. One is Fabian socialism, the idea that the state should somehow be in charge and should take the lead on all social and economic matters. And to that, Burke says, actually, this is a horrible mistake. We shouldn't be allowing politicians to arrogate that kind of power to themselves. They should be restrained, and we should be letting the institutions that sit between the individual and the state function as the way they kind. And therefore, it's a doctrine of empowering individuals and empowering institutions. The other pole of the debate is what you might call neoliberalism, and which is a kind of fetishization of the individual. And what neoliberalism essentially says is that if you just leave individuals to do whatever they like, then good things will result. And Burke says, actually, you can't be sure of that. And often that behaviour will be profoundly antisocial and counterproductive. They need to be, as it were, encased in a social order. Burke is, as it were, an antidote to what you might have seen in some of the catastrophe in the financial markets over the last 10 years. And what's so fascinating is that even within Burke's own lifetime, you know, he fights these incredible campaigns to restrain the power of the executive and to restrain the power of the East India Company. In other words, his whole life is a kind of structured by an antipathy to the abuse of power and a desire to hold all power, private and public, properly and legitimate and accountable.
I suppose, in defence of the Fabian tradition, the Fabian emphasis on the state was because they wanted to achieve certain outcomes which couldn't be achieved without external intervention. Would you say that's a kind of profoundly un-Burkean idea, that there should be an objective for politics?
It's interesting, very interesting you should put it in those terms. It's really Oakeshott later who distinguishes, Michael Oakeshott, who distinguishes between what you might call an enterprise society in which society itself is regarded as having a purpose and people are measured by their contribution to that. And that often leads in its extreme forms to a kind of totalitarianism, you know, Stakhanovite, you know, you're not a good citizen if you're not producing a certain amount of coal per day. And then that contrast would be with civil society, which says actually society doesn't have any purpose outside itself. Its job simply is to be and to allow the people within it to live their lives freely and happily. And that kind of idea is lurking in Burke, but it doesn't get developed until much later. I think what would be very surprising, and of course it's a parlour game to say what would Burke say now, but I think Burke would be very surprised to look back at, as it were, the left of the political spectrum in the year 1900, which was an extraordinary kind of pullulating mass of different institutions and ideas, ranging from anarchism at one end through guild socialism, trade unionism, mutuals, co-ops, communism, you know, an amazing array of different things, and say actually out of that is going to come a particular dominant Fabian tradition. It didn't do that in other countries in Europe, and it's surprising, I think it would be surprising to him that it did that in this country.
So let's go back to Burke the man. Tell me a little bit about his life. He was an Irishman who came to London as a lawyer.
Well, he came to London to study the law. Yes, he was born in 1730. He was from a kind of middling sort. His father was a solicitor who came from a family that had converted from Catholicism to Protestantism. And
For expedient reasons.
Well, that's right. The way to get on the future in Ireland at that time was to play ball with the English, and the English were the Protestant hegemony at the time. And the effect of that was that Catholics in Ireland had a rotten deal and had their rights grossly abused and distorted. And that is, in fact, one of Burke's great themes. And so when he gets to London in 1750, he ostensibly goes to study law at the Middle Temple, but actually he gets out of that as quickly as he possibly can because he wants to make his way as a writer and a thinker. And then there's an astonishing period about which we don't know that much, where he writes an enormous array of interesting different things and edits I think, all the Annual Register, which is still going today, and then very quickly makes his way into politics. And by 1765, he's pulled off this extraordinary conjuring trick of becoming the private secretary to the man, the Marquess of Rockingham, who then becomes the Prime Minister. And 6 months later, or 8 months later, he's in Parliament himself. And what is extraordinary about Burke is that, you know, he is this, in a way, he's the nemesis of the English aristocracy because he's an Irish adventurer, and they always regarded these people as chasing their women and seeking their fortunes. But actually, his talent is so obvious and he's so valuable to have in Parliament that people are simply dazzled. There's a wonderful moment where James Boswell says that watching Burke speak was like watching a man in an orchard with the boughs overladen with fruit, and he just pulls off the apples and pelts the ministry with them. And such was the fertility of his imagination. And of course, he's doing it at a time which is the most intergalactically talented generation in British history. I mean, you know, his contemporaries are Dr. Johnson and Garrick and Boswell and David Hume, one of our greatest ever philosophers, and Adam Smith, our greatest economist, and Joshua Reynolds, and the list goes on forever and ever. And it's just extraordinary. And so these ideas are all pullulating around, and out of them comes Burke. And then, of course, not only does he make his mark in the Commons, he starts to make his mark as an international writer and thinker. He publishes his speeches, which is something very few people have done before, and that builds some reputation. And the effect of this is that after 30 years in the Commons, although he's only ever been in government for less than 2 years, he has an international renown.
It is extraordinary that he lived in, as you put it, this pullulating intellectual environment where there's one dominant idea that everything is knowable, that you can make the world rational. And that seems to be what he sets out to refute.
Yes, of course. What's happened in the 18th century is that thoughtful people have started to reflect on the legacy of Galileo and Descartes, and above all, Isaac Newton. And what Newton's Principia did was to set down a series of axioms and postulates in the manner of the ancient Greek mathematician Euclid, from which, as far as anyone could tell, it was literally possible to deduce the physical location of anybody in the universe, past, present, and future. And therefore, this was regarded as just a completely staggering intellectual innovation, which pointed to, in principle, the possibility of the intellect and reason to be able to understand any aspect of human existence. And in the 19th century, you get Jeremy Bentham and the beginning of an attempt through utilitarianism to found all politics on the idea of science. But in the 18th century, you do find people of a scientific disposition who take the claims of reason incredibly seriously, people like Joseph Priestley and Richard Price and others. And those people are questioning the social order, they're questioning religious intolerance, they're questioning every aspect of them. And they very much warm to Burke because, Elisha at least, because his ideas are so challenging to the status quo. You know, Burke fights five great battles in his lifetime. I mean, one against the injustice being perpetrated in Ireland, and in particular, the depredations over the rights of the Catholics in Ireland. I mean, secondly, in support of the colonists and against the unwarranted extension of crown power over American colonies. Thirdly, against the extension of the monarch's influence into politics, George III being a very active monarch in a way that George II and I had not been. And then, of course, in India, fighting against the abuse of power by the East India Company. And finally, the French Revolution. And many of these causes are espoused by the rationalists, and they can't understand how it can be a consistent extension of Burke's hatred of the abuse of power then to hate the abuse of mob power in the French Revolution. What Burke's really doing is pointing out that reason can only take you so far. Reason itself has limits. And this was an idea that Kant had explored in the 1780s, although there's no evidence that I'm aware of that Burke had read Kant in philosophy. But Burke is saying, as some others had said, actually, the reason itself needs to be guided, and, as it were, what's really in charge are our emotions. And through our emotions, develop our affinities to other people and our affections and our friendships. And in these are what ground institutions. And therefore, in a sense, these are what ground society. And it's in that sense that Burke is, in a way, the first founder of the modern theory of human capital, or of a lot of the kind of thinking we have about the nature of society today.
Because that was kind of in contrast with what someone like Locke was, the way that someone like Locke would think, am I right in saying? And that one of the things that I struggle with is how you can oppose so consistently and powerfully abuses of power without having an abstract theory of what might constrain power and what justice looks like.
Yes, it's not easy to see how that works. Take the case of the idea of a right in the modern era. We think of rights in a way that Burke would regard as far too abstract. So it's absolutely standard for people to say, well, I'm a believer in human rights, or I believe in equality, or the right to free speech, or the right to this, that, and the other. For Burke, there are foundational rights. Burke is absolutely not opposed to the idea of rights as such. They were absolutely built into the legal tradition of the time. But Burke says that abstract rights, rights divorced from their context, their social context, their legal context, can have no meaning. In other words, if you're talking about a right, it's not just a right as such, it's a right to free speech under certain circumstances, and of course, as elaborated. And so what he's interested in is the rights as so-called recorded rights, rights as they develop through the law.
But he's still got to have an idea about where that right came from, and he does in
absolutely
a kind of
way,
doesn't he?
He thinks you can't understand a right unless you understand where it came from, and that's precisely his point of contrast, and therefore what he's then extremely attuned to is he regards it as an abuse. And so when the French Revolution arises and people start to say, well, actually, we believe in liberté, égalité, fraternité, completely divorced from any context, and when in that environment they then feel licensed to overturn property rights, to overturn the social order, Burke says, hold on a second, we've now slipped into ideology. These words are being used as slogans. They don't have any intellectual content. They're just being used for emotional purposes. And I'm afraid you see an awful lot of sloganeering in politics even today based on that kind of view. And it's a very cheap kind of politics. But going back a notch, it's not really Locke who Burke, I'd say, is opposed to. It's Hobbes, because it's really Hobbes with the original idea of a social contract who has this notion that, as it were, it's a very game-theoretic conception of society. So Locke says, very simply, look, in the state of nature, people live by themselves and they're dominated by the fear of violent death. And it's in order to avoid that that they get together and they give up some of their sovereignty and they empower a Leviathan. And the purpose of that sovereign is to guarantee external borders and to maintain order in society. And that's what allows society to rise. And that picture, which is very kind of economic in its ideas, very game theoretic, just makes a very simple assumption about people's motivation and gets a whole theory of legitimate government out of it. That theory is one to which Locke is, au fond, deeply, deeply opposed.
Yes, I think what I was really trying to say was that he must have some theory of legitimate government in which he can contextualise an abuse of power, for example.
Oh, there's no doubt about that at all. No, he absolutely has that. And his theory of legitimate government is one that is conditionalized. In general, it is one of a compact between the generations which license and legitimates the social order. But when that compact is violated through an oppression of an individual set of rights or a set of ways of life, then Burke can be very trenchant in advocating a right of revolution or something close to it. And so that's why he backs the American colonists, because he doesn't, and why, for example, in Poland, he backs the rights of those standing up for the Polish way of life against Catherine the Great. And so he's not opposed to that, but he wouldn't accept a Lockean right of revolution in the full sense that Locke intended.
So just expand on that interesting apparent contradiction, which really annoyed some of his erstwhile friends, the yes to America and no to France.
Yes, to his contemporaries, this looked like a volte-face, and they thought that he had done a U-turn because he had taken the king's shilling. And this, I'm afraid, was very... Thomas Paine, of whom, in many ways, the more one knows, the less one likes. But Paine was very assiduous. Paine had been Burke's friend and indeed had relied on Burke when he'd come to London to make his way in some respects. But Paine then turned on him and vigorously denounced Burke for receiving a kind of masked or secret pension. In fact, there's no evidence for that whatever. And in fact, there's no evidence that Burke was actually very punctilious in his financial relationships. He did not. I mean, he was supported by Whig aristocrats financially, but he did not feel he owed them any enormous personal duties, constantly ticking them off. And he did not enrich himself, unlike almost everyone else in government when he went into government. So Burke is pretty punctilious about that. But there was this sense, nevertheless, that Burke had somehow been a kind of turncoat or traitor to the progressives. In fact, Burke's position is wonderfully consistent. Burke cannot bear the abuse of power. And that he denounces it wherever he finds it. And what is fascinating is that, you know, even in 1780, you know, Burke, people don't really know this, but Burke frames in 1780 a memorandum for the regulation of the slave trade prior to its abolition. This is 7 years before the abolition movement even gets going. And so it's just extraordinary. He's always, and he gets into terrible trouble because he supports the cause of debtors, you know, and says they shouldn't be thrown into prison for failure to pay our debts. These are commercial judgments rather than criminal errors or mistakes. You know, he gets into terrible trouble with his local electors because he is against the punitive treatment of a man who's been convicted for sodomy. You know, lots and lots of causes on which he always takes the side of the underdog. And there's a moment where he says, if I had to take my place, I would take it with the poor, the meek, the humble. And he, that is his position. What he cannot bear is the abuse of power. What he sees is the social order being overturned. And that is the red line. You have to do everything you can to protect a legitimate social order. And even though the French social order in 1789 was not, I think it's fair to say, and Burke would have said, fully legitimate, although Louis XVI was a reforming monarch, he certainly didn't think that warranted overturning it altogether and expropriating people and destroying society as they knew it.
So what would he have done? How could, in Burkean terms, you ameliorate the condition of the ordinary man or woman in the French street?
Burke thinks all power carries responsibility with it, and all power has to earn its own legitimacy as it goes by the actions it takes to ameliorate the conditions of people in society. And so he would have been, I think, very supportive of reforming measures in France as he was in Britain. The difficulty was that in France, as I'm afraid we have seen since in North Africa and other places, it's always when you go from repression to a period of modest reform that you then get revolution. And exactly the same was the case. You know, Louis XVI, for all his faults, wasn't making attempts to reform. He calls an Estates General for the first time in, you know, 160 years in France because he's trying to get everyone behind a set of changes that to the tax system that will now reform. And it's that that then spirals out of control and creates the preconditions for the French Revolution.
Moving slightly reluctantly on to the present day, the legacy. Looking at the reviews of your book, I think the most fulsome probably comes from John Cruddas, who's obviously a Labour MP, but very interested in Labour ideas and very interested probably in Burkean ideas about the role of society.
Yes. I mean, I think John and Maurice Glassman, who's another great Burkean, and Stuart Wood, who are the kind of people around Ed Miliband, I think they understand that the terms of politics have changed and that, you know, it's no longer enough to be able to say, actually, we need to return to state first. And on the other hand, no one thinks that, as it were, aggressively libertarian or neoliberal approaches to social policy or economic policy are going to yield the outcome. So, and most of all, in a situation where we've got potentially 20 years of austerity, as the Cabinet Secretary has recently said. And so they're thinking, rightly in my view, how can we make the deck we've got, how can we make the system we've got, the social order we've got, work better? And that's a very productive and interesting kind of politics. And it avoids the cheap cop-outs of saying we'll just spend a lot more money. And it meets the current government, which a lot of whose work is about making institutions work better, whether they're local government or institutions of the state and the welfare, you know, et cetera, schools. It meets them on what I think is the right turf for politics over the next few decades. And the question is really whether they'll be allowed to pursue that fascinating agenda within the Labour Party, because at some point there's going to be a very strong pull from the leadership, from the Shadow Chancellor, from the unions to say, actually, okay, this is enough faffing around, enough with this, we will not put, let's go back to the kind of setup we had in the 70s and 80s. And I think that is going to be a real worry.
Burke, of course, probably would have been with Ian Duncan Smith and the matter of state support for people who need help.
He would be very worried about actions that lead to dependence and that sap and enervate people's energies.
I wonder how one can balance that.
I mean, it's a historical conundrum of social policy. Political parties in this country, for time immemorial, have always regarded it as their duty to protect the least well-off in society. However, if social policy is too generous, you end up encouraging lots of people who could be working and living fulfilling independent lives to become reliant on the state. And that is disastrous for them, and it's disastrous for society as a whole.
What about party, which was kind of, in a way, kind of one of Burke's great insights, wasn't it? The kind of importance of party.
So Burke is, in a way, the first great theorist of parties. There were ideas of political party floating around in the 18th century, and they came out of the exclusion crisis when an attempt had been made to prevent James, the Duke of York, from becoming the king after the death of Charles II. And these great parties of Whigs versus Tories split up then. By the time you get to the late 18th century, those aren't really the same kinds of Whigs or Tories, and the party system doesn't work in the same way. There'd been a lot of worry about parties because it was regarded as opposition to the monarch, and therefore in some sense seditious and potentially treasonous. But what Burke does brilliantly is to show in a Thoughts on the Cause of the Present Discontents in 1770 that parties, properly understood, can be very, very good for government because they discipline what otherwise would be factions, because they are formed as factions are not formed, they are formed around ideas of public policy and public principles. Those principles get publicly debated and brought into government. Because they already exist as an opposition, power can flow from one side of the political divide to the other without an upheaval or a revolution. They also are very good for recruiting talent into politics and for allowing people, ideally from any walk of life, to be successful in politics. And so political parties become not sources of opposition, not factions, but paraconstitutional aids to good government. And that was a remarkably important codification of ideas that were happening at the time. And what's fascinating, again, is Burke is regarded as the kind of lackey of the Whig aristocrats for saying this. We've now discovered, and I talk about in the book, an essay that's just been attributed to him for the first time, which showed that even 13 years earlier, you know, way before he's even anywhere near politics, Burke has already worked out this theory of parties in 1757. He doesn't get into Parliament until 1765. He's not even thinking about politics. So it's another reason why the idea that somehow he's the lickspittle of a particular political grouping is completely wrong.
The interesting question is how you revive parties now.
Well, it's a vital question because if you absorb a Burkean view of it, then parties aren't something you can dispense with without tremendous constitutional loss. And I don't think Burke's got a kind of recipe, but in general, what you are looking for is a proper balance between the ability of a duly elected government to get its legislation through Parliament, which requires a majority and which avoids a lot of what you see in other countries, which is factional infighting, buying off of interests, money politics, special interest politics, that kind of stuff.
Arguably, it happens in a different forum.
Well, it may do, but I mean, if you want a contrast, and look at for example what's happening in America at the moment. In America, you have two elected houses, an upper house and a lower house. The effect of that is, and because they're elected, they're on a par with each other. Each can originate, not merely originate legislation, but block the other's legislation because it has to pass both houses. Now, the effect of that is that the lobby groups have two huge bites at the cherry, and no administration, because there isn't such a thing as an administration in that sense, can, in the final analysis, force its democratically mandated legislation through the government. The effect of that, or into government, the effect of that is you have paralysis, gridlock, and an explosion of the money power. And if you combine that with a constitutional protection on spending as an expression of free speech, you are ending up with the politics of catastrophe.
Do you think David Cameron's Conservative Party, do you think it can still claim the name Compassionate Conservatism?
Oh, I don't have any doubt about that at all. The don't forget, the compassion that we're talking about isn't pity. Pity isn't really a principle, can't be made into a principle of statecraft. The compassion that certainly I've been talking about is what Adam Smith would call sympathy, or what Burke might call fellow feeling. It's that affinity that builds up in society, and that grounds institutions, and that allows people to identify themselves with each other or with a cause. And that really arises from a rich conception of the human individual and the possibility of human flourishing, and a desire to empower these institutions that sit between. If you think about what gives people their purpose and point in their lives, it's, you know, the football club they support, it's the church they belong to, it's the, you know, the pub they go to around the corner, it's the school their kids go to. You know, it's those kinds of things that get people going, and it's those kinds of institutions that have to be allowed to flourish if they possibly can be. And so, for example, I think a Burkean conservatism would be very worried about, you know, the extent to which the high streets are being put under pressure by supermarkets, and that individual retailers, independent retailers, are being forced out of action, because that feels like these institutions being oppressed by forces that have been allowed to kind of become unbalanced. And I think, therefore, you see lots of social policy that's about redressing that balance and not allowing any part of society to get too big for its boots. The same ditto, obviously, with the financial sector.
But Burke was describing a world that was much smaller in lots of ways. It was much smaller, just felt much smaller in geographically, but it was also much smaller in terms of the people who talk to one another. And I wonder really how far you can... he can be relevant or accommodated in a, you know, hugely interconnected world?
Well, it's a very interesting question. Of course, it was a much smaller population at the time Britain had, but, you know, there were remarkably good communications, even at a time when literacy was very low. You had lots of, you know, you had a very flourishing press. You had mechanisms by which news very quickly percolated into the countryside, and people would have the latest news read to them from sheets and newspapers. So I don't think there's any difference in as it were, in the ability of people to absorb Burke's lessons now as opposed to then. And I would say there are, you know, he's got lessons that are completely applicable in many, many ways. We've talked about the evils of extreme liberalism. I don't think there's any doubt that we've understood that message now. And if you look at the psychological evidence now on things like money priming, you know, if you surround someone with images of money, there's lots of evidence they become more individualistic and more greedy. So, you know, you can imagine what happens now with the massively consumerist and materialist culture we have at the moment. You know, although Burke doesn't believe in, massive handouts, and certainly says so in one or two places, he does believe that the function of government is to improve the condition of the people, and all the people, not just, as it were, the rich. I mean, then you have another great working lesson for the modern era is don't go gallivanting off on these great, imaginative international adventures. I mean, one of Burke's great lines about Lord North at the time of the crisis in the American colonies, he says Lord North is a man who consults his invention and rejects his experience. In other words, it's a standing rebuke to all politicians who think they can just kind of imagine their way to an outcome rather than actually reflecting hard about it. And then we've got a lesson about restraints on abuse of power and taking on vested interests. That's a very helpful idea of reform, the importance of gradual reform and modest political leadership, the value of representative government, the reassertion of the value of the rule of law, the duties of the politician as a representative, not merely as a delegate acting on instructions. And this whole stuff about social value, the recovery of social value, social capital. I think all that stuff, theory of revolutions, so valuable now as we start to think about Burke's the first great theorist of revolutions. So I think there's an astonishing number of areas where Burke's lessons are not merely fascinating in his own time, but incredibly timely for ours. And I've tried to bring that out along with a lot of jokes and other kind of gossip and stuff in the book.
Jesse Norman, thank you very much indeed. And you can catch Jesse at the Edinburgh International Books Festival on Sunday, the 11th of August at 4:30. Tickets are on sale now. The producer of Politics Weekly is Phil Maynard. I'm Anne Perkins. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.